Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
In many popular accounts of contemporary quote-unquote Western society, there is an inherent contradiction between the principles underlying liberal secularism and Islam. This type of binary discourse about religion and secular naturalizes these differences and promotes the seeming rigidity of the two categories. But secularism is much messier than that. Danielle Hawk questions this simplistic narrative in her new book, Interrogating Secularism: Race and Religion in Arab Transnational Art and Literature, published with Syracuse University Press in 2019. She deconstructs liberal accounts of secularism through an examination of the work of authors and artists from ethnic and religious minorities. The literary and visual economies that inform their art demonstrates that secular values are not always neatly distinguished from religious principles, nor are spiritual forms necessarily steeped in tradition. In our conversation, we discuss secular ideologies, contemporary Orientalism, the racialization of Muslims, the war on terror, state surveillance, visual and literary cultural production, transnational identities, publishing norms, museum practices, human rights discourses, Muslim feminist praxis, and LGBTQ identities. I'm one of your co-hosts, Christian Peterson, and thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies, a channel on the New Books Network. Without any further delay, here's my conversation with Danielle Hawk about Interrogating Secularism, Race and Religion in Arab Transnational Art and Literature. Welcome, Danielle, to New Books in Islamic Studies. Thanks for joining me. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk about this really interesting book, Interrogating Secularism. But before we get into that, we always like to know a little bit about our authors, what brought them to their subjects, and how they approach them. So can you tell us a little bit about your training, perhaps influences or mentors or moments that kind of shaped the trajectory that your work has taken shape?
Absolutely. I have been interested in religion and literature my entire life. I was raised in a very religious family. As an undergraduate, I even wrote my senior thesis on medieval Sufi poetry. And I went on to do a master's in divinity. I wrote about theology and U.S. literature. And so I went into my PhD program at Cornell thinking about religion and literature and knowing that's what I wanted to work on. And in 2008, I took a trip to Switzerland to visit American friends that were living there. And this was when the Swiss government was holding a referendum on banning minarets. I don't know if you remember that happening. And in the town I was visiting, a right-wing group had put up all these signs supporting this ban. And they had all these posters. And on the posters, there was a woman in a niqab. She was sort of swathed in black cloth. And there was a Swiss flag with minarets shaped like missiles kind of coming up out of the flag, and she and the missile minarets sort of mimicked each other. And it was this obvious gendered threat to Swiss values and to feminism. And none of this surprised me. The referendum didn't surprise me, the posters, but my friends' reactions to it really did surprise me, because they said, oh, isn't it great we have religious freedom in America. This could never happen in the United States. We would never ban minarets. And this happened after the Patriot Act, after Guantanamo Bay, after the protests about the proposed Islamic Center near the World Trade Center, after NYPD was spying on Muslims. And so in the US, I think we hear about this value of religious freedom and secular governance a lot, even though the US has oppressed its religious minorities from its very beginning. So from Native genocide to colonial era anti-Catholic laws to 19th century massacres of Mormons, the US uses religious freedom to oppress other populations. This week, two Supreme Court justices spoke about overturning marriage rights in the name of religious freedom. So this faith that they had in religious freedom and how it was such a different context from Switzerland really surprised me. And so this is what got me thinking about secularism in the United States. And one of my dissertation advisors sort of steered me towards reading about secularism and theories about secularism. And I came to the conclusion that the solution to this is not less racist or less homophobic secular governance, because Western secularism is foundationally designed to be exclusionary. And I think in a lot of fields, so for example, if you're in the fields of Middle East, North African, or Islamic studies, the question of why talk about secularism is really evident. So an example being the Swiss banning of minarets, or the French banning religious symbols and burkini bans, and Quebec's secularism laws, and the fact that even in the United States, since 2010, we have had over 200 anti-Sharia law bills introduced in 43 states. So the question of why secularism in a lot of fields is evident. In literary studies, I think maybe it is less so. So the arguments that I make are maybe less evident. But what I came to think about this in my reading about secularism is that if we can talk about secularism in the way that we talk about religion, as embodied, as something we practice, then our cultural production, like literature and visual arts, must also reflect and shape that embodiment. And so in reading about secularism in literature, I was reading a lot of scholars that showed how canonical literature and its various genres, so things like the coming of age story or the Buildings Roman, they naturalize what are Protestant values into civic ones. So scholars like Tracy Fessenden start this work by looking at the Puritans. She works her way up through the 20th century. And what she and most other scholars that work in this field are doing is showing how literature helps Protestant values become the ones that we consider to be secular values. And I was not interested in writing about that. I wanted to look at literature that sort of bristled against Western secularism. I wasn't interested in literature that made claims of belonging on assimilation. I wasn't interested in books about tolerance. I wasn't interested in insider memoirs. I wanted to look at literature that exposed the workings of Western secularism, particularly thinking about it in terms of the secular laws and surveillance practices that targeted Muslim and Arab populations. And so that is how I came to work on the fiction and art that's in this book.
That's really fascinating. And yes, I definitely remember those images that you're talking about. It's a very striking image, that poster. So you've kind of started to tackle this a little bit, but one of the kind of main threads through the book is this kind of idea or thesis that modern secularism is at odds with Islam in some way. You start to kind of tackle this through basically these case studies. But to kind of set us up, how do secular ideologies and contemporary Orientalism intersect in your project? Because I think this is probably one of the keys to understanding a lot of this literature and art. I guess, what do these categories mean in your project?
Well, I think, first of all, I see this all the time. I'm seeing this in debates about the Supreme Court justice nominee right now, is that secularism, we imagine it as neutral and abstract, that it's just religion-free public spaces and governance, that it's sort of marching us forward towards this perfect progressive civilization. But what secularism does is create this binary between rational and irrational, between progress and traditionalism. And secularism, in fact, tells us what religion should be and how it should be practiced properly under secularism. And the reason Islam has become so important in these discourses of secularism is because Islam is represented in these Western discourses as anti-modern, anti-secular, just antithetical to secularism and sort of liberal democratic governance generally. So you can't talk about secularism in the West without talking about Islam. And all of the policies and laws that I was talking about before in Switzerland, in France, in Canada, the United States, and there's so many more examples that I could give you, really set up this this conflict between Islam and sort of the ideals of Western liberal secularism, which is to say Islam is portrayed as being less civilizational, is not being invested in human rights or in women's rights. And this is this is one of the reasons that I was so interested in looking at the books that I look at, because they don't set up, they refuse this binary between secularism and Islam entirely. They refuse this binary between secularism and religion. And they refuse the idea that Western secularity has a monopoly on the values of religious freedom or bodily sovereignty or individual rights or gender equality, sexual liberation, and so on. They demonstrate how these supposedly secular values often manifest in really exclusionary ways in actual spaces. Because what secularism does is it sanctions certain kinds of religious expression and embodiment while discounting others, including Islam, as just irreconcilable to secular governance. And Islam is sort of the case studies that I'm looking at. But this has been true of a number of ways that secularism sort of excludes populations, including, and I think this is a really sort of rich area for scholarship, native studies, the way that secularism, for example, has us thinking about and conceptualizing private property in really specific ways, or something like corporate personhood, ways that refuse other human and communal forms of understanding our relationship to land, for example. So Islam and secularism, in a sense, 9/11, but 9/11, I don't think is necessarily the watershed moment that our media makes it out to be. Certainly Muslims and Arabs were being surveilled prior to 9/11, but certainly since 9/11, this, what Samuel Huntington called this clash of civilizations, has really come to the forefront of our political rhetoric. And we see that in all sorts of ways, like Trump's Muslim ban or Newt Gingrich thinking that people need to take like Sharia tests and things like that. So it becomes sort of essential to talk about Islam when you're talking about secular governance in the West.
Something else that I really appreciate about the book is your kind of attention to categories and classification and these kind of things. And these two categories of Arab and Muslim, of course, play this central role throughout. And you kind of place these within the context of the racialization of Muslims and state power and surveillance, like you were mentioning. And then, of course, this secular and religious dichotomy. But you push back against some sort of centralizing discourse about Arab or Muslim as a category. But I'd love to hear more about how you think we should approach these labels analytically when thinking about cultural production. So, for example, could we think of a quote unquote Muslim literature as a genre or a collective? How do you probe or tackle these kind of questions in your book?
I think it's really important that my book is specifically about Arab transnational art and literature. And this, I talk a lot about the really particular history of racialization of Arabs in the United States. But because of how Islam is raced in the U.S. and Europe, even though some of the authors and artists that I'm talking about are not Muslim authors and artists, Islam becomes essential and over in this overlapping category that I need to talk about as well. So I talk about the racing of Islam as non-white. And Eric Love writes about this. He writes about Muslims becoming a racial category. And Nouri Ghana writes about what he calls the Islamifying, which is a difficult word to say, of Arab Americans. So that it sort of works in these two ways. Islam becomes a raced category and Arabs become sort of Islamified. And these categories get collapsed and they become monolithic. So what I wanted to do in my book was really pay particular attention to keeping categories distinct and showing how they overlap, and also showing how things like policy and law and surveillance force these overlappings. So, for example, after 9/11, the Arab and Muslim category become even more collapsed into a monolith that needs to be policed. And I think I would call myself someone who's in the field of Arab American studies, but also in the field of Muslim American studies. And I would understand these categories as having something to do with each other and intersecting, but not being identical. And I think Moja Kaf, who is one of the authors that I write about in the book, she writes really beautifully about the idea of Muslim American literature. And she finds its roots in the Black Muslim tradition in the United States. So even in thinking about something like where these traditions emerge from, so if you're thinking about the Arab American literary tradition, you're thinking about the great wave of immigration that came from the 1880s through the 1920s from greater Syria. And, you know, it follows this very different trajectory. It's the New York Pen League. It's the mid-century writers. It's the anthologies that were gathered together in the 1980s and 1990s that were really important to this category of Arab American literature. Muslim American literature has this really different trajectory. And Moja Kaf and Sylvia Chan Malik and others sort of root that trajectory in the Middle Passage. And they find its beginnings in the transatlantic slave trade. And so I think it's really important to keep these histories in mind, that they have something to do with each other, but that we have to respect them as these distinct histories that are imbued with different meaning and context. And I think it's really important to think of that specifically about the relationship between sort of Black Muslim identity and history in the United States and immigrant Muslim history and tradition in the United States, and the sort of relationship that these have to do with each other.
Yeah, and I think you do this really well. And anybody working on, you know, Muslims and popular culture, or Arab Americans and popular culture, I think this is now required reading. You think you really do an excellent job of parsing out, you know, ways of thinking about the intersections of these two categories, but then also where they line up with different trajectories. So it's you do a wonderful job. And so you begin the kind of case study, so to speak, with Leila Lalami and Rawi Hajj. So some of these figures might not be well known to a lot of listeners. So can you start by telling us a little bit about who these authors are and their novels? If for these two, you use them to start thinking about questions of humanity and being human. So what do they tell us about being human, and how might they help us think about you know, secular categories or definitions of human rights?
So Leila Lalami is a Moroccan author who sometimes resides in the United States and writes in English. So I include her in this book, and I write about sort of the reasons why I find her appropriate to include. And she's written a number of books, including The Moors Account, which I'll just make for a plug for right now, which is about takes up the story of the conquistadors to the United States, but from the point of view of an enslaved Moroccan person. And the book that I write about is Hope and Other Dangerous Pursuits, which is about a group of Moroccans who make the passage across the Straits of Gibraltar to Spain. And the author that I pair her with is Rawi Haj, and he is a Canadian Lebanese author. And here I also, again, sort of make the argument for including them. He also writes in English. His book takes place in Montreal, which is sort of Montreal and Quebec are sort of the seat of secularism laws and movements in Canada. And that what that chapter does is it takes up, and a lot of what my book does is it takes up these seemingly benevolent genres and institutions that are secular that we kind of assume are inherently good. So in this chapter, it's the human rights novel. And I sort of question the foundations of those genres and what it is that they're doing. And I look at Lalami and Haj as writers of human rights narratives. They're both writing about migrants, Lalami going from Morocco to Spain, and Haj's book about a group of migrants in Montreal. And I sort of think about human rights discourses and the secular ideologies that underpin them, right? So this idea that, I mean, who doesn't like human rights? We all want human rights. But the idea that these human rights discourses that emerge during the Enlightenment take for granted the human as this individual, this autonomous individual that has agency, and the ways in which this conception of the human works to exclude huge populations throughout the history of human rights regimes. So women, children, the mentally ill, incarcerated people, enslaved people, colonized people. And so asking the question is, what is it about these sort of Enlightenment ideals about human rights that still inform how we think about human rights today? How are they marshaled to exclude certain populations of people? And what I do is look at these books by Lalami and Haj that don't humanize, because a lot of the work that human rights novels generally do is humanize an other for an audience. So I think about this a lot in terms of how my students react to human rights literature. When I ask them, you know, what is it that a human rights novel does, or what is this book we're looking at do? And they'll say things like, oh, it, you know, it bears witness, it raises my awareness, it humanizes the other or the foreigner. And so these books resist that idea that an author has to humanize somebody who is already human in order for a reader to feel empathy for those characters. And then by extension, empathy for the people that it represents. So these human rights novels don't humanize. They don't accumulate an individual success, but instead, Lalami's in particular ends with this idea of relationality. So none of her characters are particularly successful. So for example, one of her characters is a sex worker, and she is not sort of saved from her sex work in Spain. She is not liberated through Spanish sort of liberal feminism, but instead her chapter ends with this face-to-face encounter with her roommate where they prepare a meal together. The protagonist ends up being deported back to Morocco and working in a tourist shop. And he also does not end up sort of like saved and redeemed. Instead, he starts to think about how he wants to write for his community of people. So it's very much about not individual success, but this idea of relationality, that we are socially embedded, that we are communal. And so it sort of thwarts this Enlightenment progression towards individual success and autonomy. And it's this Hodges is particularly interesting to me because his doesn't actually end in relationality in that sense. His sort of scraps the species of the human altogether, and he becomes a cockroach. Sort of abandons the idea of individualism, and his character in the end murders somebody and sort of slides down into the sewers to join all the other cockroaches. So he refuses the human altogether. And I think this is really interesting because he writes this human rights novel, which takes up the stories of all of these immigrants in exile, and it shows how they are continually dehumanized. And it also, again, doesn't appeal to us as readers to sort of humanize and identify with his protagonist. His protagonist is a thief. He's very sexist. He stalks his therapist. He's an altogether sort of repulsive character. And instead, we're meant to sort of identify this humanist despite his sort of inhumanity. And I think that what these two novels are doing is giving us examples of human rights novels that don't pander, that don't sort of demand that the characters or the author or the people that they represent are innocent and grateful and somehow must make themselves seem deserving of our empathy. Instead, it gives us characters that sort of refuse that trajectory. And that's really unusual in the human rights novel.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
In the second chapter, you move towards art and museum culture within this kind of intersection of religion and secularity. And you focus on the visual practices of Ninar Esper. In your study, is non-Western art treated in museum practices and then also in kind of broader discourses on art? Who is this artist that you focus on, and how does her work help us in decolonizing museum cultures?
So Nina Esper is a Lebanese author who works in Lebanon and France, and whose work is in her visual art. She does visual and also performance art and installation art. And it often sort of uses French and English and Arabic, and it uses religious imagery. And what I do, I spend a lot of time in this chapter talking about how museum cultures, again, another institution that I think we might think of as being relatively benevolent, how museum cultures sort of essentialize artists and their production, and how they shape through exhibition the experience of viewers. So I talk a lot about what it means to be a member of the public viewing this art, and how museums work to, first of all, secularize art, how art itself is a secular category as a really important sort of moment in art history, like the artist as a solitary genius, how we experience art as transcendent through just the experience of art itself, that these are really important moments in sort of secular art history, and how museums sort of sort of make decisions about which art is religious and which artists are represented as being artists that produce religious art. So I talk about exhibits, for example, that include, a wide variety of artists. I talk about specific exhibits that frame artists from the Middle East or Arab American artists as being distinctly as Muslim artists, even when their art has nothing to do or very little to do with Islam or is about something else entirely. And I also talk about how museums, the sort of history of museums considering themselves as sort of state stewards of sacred or religious art. So I tie this way in which Arab artists are Arab and a lot of other artists are sort of essentialized and sort of reductively exhibited to this history of museums in the United States and elsewhere, seeing themselves as stewards, for example, of native art, for deciding how to, that they must like protect and preserve art from the people who produce it and who may want to utilize it in ways that don't have to do with displaying it in a museum, right? So thinking about like, how is sacred art displayed in our museum, in our museums? Like how is something like native art displayed? What does it mean to consider yourself a steward or protector of somebody else's art and tradition, to protect it essentially from the people who make it? And I also talk about what it means to decolonize a museum. So what does it mean to acknowledge these histories of colonialism and the theft of art and the refusal to return art? And I tie that to different exhibitions and the way that they present artists specifically in the United States. And when I talk about Nina Espar, the exhibit that I begin with is one that was actually in Greece. It was called A World Not Ours. And I talk about the ways in which artists like Nina Espar defy these categorizations of being secular or religious. So she uses religious imagery in her art, but it isn't in this way in which she's sort of translating it for a non-religious audience, and it isn't meant to secularize religious imagery. Like she uses sacred imagery in a way that is neither wholly secular or wholly religious. And so it sort of blurs these binaries. And I talk about some of the ways that she does that. For example, the way like she does recitations that she calls the 99 names. I talk about one of her exhibits that's called Torso 2, and it's this sort of glimmering, these huge metal necklaces, they're rendered in gold, that are the names of US and British and Israeli and French military operations in the Middle East. They have these really beautiful names like Rain of Fire and Pillar of Cloud, and how she sort of hangs these together as jewelry or as trophies. She uses this sort of imagery to sort of help us think about the violence of these names and how it is not narrated in the United States or Britain or France is Israel, but instead these are told of stories of liberation and righteous occupations. So I would say that what Nina Espar's work does is she pushes back against this interest in creating cross-cultural understanding, right, between the secular West and Islam, or the ways that the Middle East is sort of represented uncritically or is essentialized, right? So her exhibitions attempt to resist this idea of multiculturalism and, again, resist humanizing or translating the Arab world or the Middle East for Western publics. So she sort of challenges all of these traditional modes of exhibition through her work.
So you move from the museum back to literature, and you brought up Mozhakov earlier, but in the third chapter, you focus specifically on her novel, The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf, which maybe more listeners are familiar with the story. It's a very well-known book, of course, and you kind of use it as a moment to think about constructing a feminist praxis you know, caught in the middle or between these secular and religious formations. So can you just kind of introduce us briefly to the narrative in the novel? And then why did you feel this was particularly helpful in thinking about this kind of intersection of Islam and liberal secularism? And then in this novel, what role does gender play in that?
Well, Moshe Koff is a Syrian-American author. She has written numerous books of poetry. I write about The Girl in the Tangerine Scarf, which is about a young Syrian girl and her family, and she's growing up in Indiana, and it's a coming-of-age story. So it's, you know, she's growing up in a devout family. She grows up in a religious Muslim family, and it takes her through high school and college and marriage and divorce and sort of through her career. And one of the things I think that's really interesting about this book is that it's a coming of age story that doesn't end in this sort of trajectory of someone sort of rejecting the, you know, the traditions that they come from and embarking on, you know, sort of assimilating into the culture. And it takes a very different turn. And I think a lot of what the book pushes against is this idea in Western feminism that women's rights can only emerge from the secular context, that women in Islam are inherently oppressed. That's something like the veil, which is a trope in the novel about, you know, there's a lot of moments when Khadra veils or unveils. She speaks a lot about what it means, veiling means to her in the novel, this Khadra being the protagonist. And so this book really pushes against this idea that Muslim women don't have agency, that they don't have rights within Islam, and that Islam is inherently oppressive to women. One of the other interesting things that this book does is it finds within the secular context a way for Khadra to enact her rights. So in the book, it is a wife-initiated divorce, and she has an abortion in the book, and how she can enact these rights in this secular context. But she understands them not as being sort of available to her because she's in the United States and those are rights that the United States sort of grants her. But she understands that she should have access to these rights through her Islamic theology. So she understands her ability to have these rights and her sort of desire to enact these rights as being really rooted in her understanding of Islam and the Quran. And so when the book ends, she's gotten a divorce, she's had an abortion, which she sort of understands theologically, and she's embarked on a career. And so it ends in one way, it ends as sort of a way that you might imagine a trajectory of a novel of sort of a woman finding herself or finding liberation. But what this novel does that is so different is it finds those rights, and she is able to sort of live her life by understanding herself relationally to her community and understanding that the secular context is one way in which she can enact not only her rights, but like understand herself as belonging to the Ummah, this sort of transnational, international, global community of Muslims. And so it doesn't have that sort of wrap up that the coming of age novel usually has.
You also look at questions of sexual identity within secular discourses, and specifically LGBTQ rights. And you look at the author Rabi Alameddine and his book Kool-Aids, The Art of War. maybe I wasn't familiar with this work, so maybe other listeners won't either, but I found this really interesting also because it kind of takes place in this kind of pre-9/11 context, which, you know, in a kind of different type of cultural war, in a sense. So can you tell us a little bit about Alameddine and his novel, and then how does his work help us interrogate LGBTQ identities, American literature, representation of Arabs and Muslims? You do a lot in this chapter, of course, but maybe you can kind of help us think about this.
This is Alameddine's weirdest book. So it's so strange. I think you probably got that from reading the chapter. It is such a strange book. It is so hard to describe. It is not chronological. It happens in these episodes that sort of move weirdly through time and space. So I'll say that it is the Alameddine's a Lebanese writer. He writes in English. And this book is both about the Lebanese Civil War. So parts of it take place in Lebanon. And it is also about the AIDS epidemic in the United States. And the episodes are just so chaotic, which is part of, you know, what I think the book is doing. But I would say, you know, for those of you not ready for a really strange and chaotic read, go read one of his other books. They're excellent. But what I talk about in this book, and I talk a lot about sort of the way that he juxtaposes the Lebanese Civil War with the AIDS epidemic, but I'll talk more about what he does with his gay characters, and they are almost entirely gay. It's a novel almost entirely about gay men, so it's sort of gendered in that sense, and how he talks about sort of the AIDS epidemic, because one of the things that this novel points to is the way that, for example, the West is seen as a place where sort of the sole location for sexual liberation and LGBT rights, and how this is sort of foundationally not the case. I mentioned the Supreme Court at the beginning of this conversation, and so it is evident that that this sort of secular governance doesn't deliver rights in sort of the ways that it promises to, and yet it's sort of seen as the only place for sort of the queer liberation. That the secular is the only sort of space and source for this. And Kool-Aids, which is the title of the book, and of course could refer to so many things. Kool-Aid really questions the presumption that secularity, this presumption of secularity, that queer people can only truly be free under secular conditions, because it making queerness into the secular concept. And it does this by having a multitude of different characters. It's difficult to even talk about a protagonist in this book, but it does it by having a multitude of characters that have varying degrees of faith in different religions. And it also does it by talking about the AIDS epidemic, and how the US government, its refusal to address this epidemic just charted the course of death and suffering in the United States for gay and homeless and addicted populations in the United States. And it ties this neglect of AIDS patients and populations into the civil war in Lebanon in really interesting ways. And it also talks about, and it sort of points to the ways that Western secularity, or the idea that you can only have LGBT rights under a really particular kind of secular regime, is used for pinkwashing, meaning it's used to paint the Middle East and Islam as being also like the Kafka chapter where I talked about Islam being sort of represented as inherently anti-feminist, as being inherently homophobic. And there's a lot of scholars that talk about the way that this is used. Jasper Pure talks about the way pinkwashing is used in relationship to Israel, which is not in this book, but it is certainly one way to think about, like, what is this book doing? Thinking about the ways in which it points to how secularism is marshaled to exclude not only these Arab and Muslim populations in the United States, but GLBT people as well.
In the final chapter, you move to Muslim art in a post 9/11 context, and you think about how secularism shapes kind of dominant visual registers in many ways. So you look at a couple artists and how they respond to these kind of perceived limits. So what do the artists that you focus on, what do they have to say about the social and political conditions of the war on terror and state surveillance and the regulation and policing of communities? How does their art push back against some of this?
So I talk about two artists, Monir Fatmi, and Hassan Elahi. And Hassan Elahi is not Arab. He is a Bangladeshi American artist. His work is really interesting. I'll start with Monir Fatmi, a lot of the work that I talk about in the book has to do specifically with representations of, for example, the World Trade, the skyline of New York before 9/11, and with images of sort of suicide bombers, and thinking about how post 9/11 sort of surveillance and policing worked. And again, I talk a lot about how he uses religious symbols in his art, like again, the 99 names of Allah and calligraphy, and how he doesn't translate them. And I'll say a little bit about the cover of the book. The piece on the cover of the book, my book is called Interrogating Secularism, and the piece on the cover is this circular saw, and it's inscribed with quotations from the Quran, and it's beautifully done. My father was a metal worker, and he was so impressed by the gorgeous steelwork that Fatmi does, but it's also a quite an intimidating piece. And at first I thought this piece was mainly about power, or maybe about how Islam is represented specifically in the U.S. as sort of threatening, because these words from the Quran are inscribed on circular saws. But then I started doing home repair, and I thought about how the saws that I was using were actually about creation and how you use them in the act of creating and building. And the saws in this piece are set up so they look like they could turn like gears. And so you can sort of imagine if one idea turns, if one quotation turns, if these words make a movement, then all of the other gears in the piece would move, right? So they don't actually move, but you can sort of, they're set up in this way that they look not only like saws and like gears, but they can move. So it's really dynamic. It's about creation, and it uses these quotations from the Quran that are specifically about knowledge. And so I think pieces like that are ways to challenge the sort of representation in the media of Islam as inherently threatening and terroristic, right? By showing it as dynamic and in the process of creation, and by using religious imagery in ways that these passages aren't translated. You only know what these passages are if you know what these passages are, right? So it doesn't secularize the imagery that he uses. And Hassan Elahi, his piece that I write about in this, does something very different. His piece is really interesting. So he was stopped upon returning to the United States after a trip that was post 9/11, and he was interrogated. And so he decided after this interrogation that he would produce an online diary that's called Tracking Transients. And in this online diary, it would just be filled with images from his daily life. So none of the images are of him. They're all of the things that he's doing all day long, and a GPS tracker that tracks him all the time. So if you go to Tracking Transients, you will find years worth of images and GPS data that track him. And his idea was, I am going to create this sort of performance digital art piece that uses like technologies of surveillance. So he uses GPS, which was originally a military application, and then is used in all sorts of ways. So he's going to use this surveillance technology to surveil himself and then just flood the internet or flood these intelligence agencies with information about himself. So his actual, like, the site shows who has looked at it. So the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, these are all agencies that have accessed his work to kind of see it, which is interesting because it's surveillance of his surveillance happening in real time. And one of the things that the piece does is it's really confusing. So I mean, I guess I worked on more than one confusing piece in this book. First, Alameddine's book, Kool-Aids, and then this piece, Tracking Transients, because you can't really figure out necessarily, like, you can't kind of navigate the site. There's no way to be like, where was he on November 2nd? The site is impossible to navigate. It has huge amounts of information and it aggregates information. So, like, you can look at one picture and it will show urinals from hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of days of urinal use, not him using it, but just the urinal, right? Or like food that he's eaten, or, you know, trips that he's taken, or things that he's bought, or credit card receipts or things, and it's impossible to track. And so the point of this piece is about this sort of incessant surveillance and using these technologies of surveillance to sort of satirically take on these intelligence agencies. And it's really interesting because he's using, you know, things like, even when you go and look it up, you have to, if you Google it, you're sort of using these technologies that track you while you're looking at the art, right? So all of my movements through his piece are tracked, even as he tracks himself. So it's about the intense scrutiny that sort of Muslims have endured since 9/11. And then it's also about these sort of digital technologies that we voluntarily use to track ourselves.
Danielle, there's really tons in this book, and I hope people will get it, because I think you do communicate to a lot of different disciplines in really productive ways. I don't know if there's any final thoughts that I want to give the opportunity, if there's anything else you want readers to know or come away with from the book.
I think what I want readers to know is that this isn't a wholesale critique on secularism, that I'm not saying to, that none of the authors, I think, can be used to say that secularism should not exist, and that we should be living under some kind of like religious regime or something. But what that these authors do is point to the ways that secularism doesn't guarantee religious freedom equally to all the people that live under its governance, that live in the state. That, for example, stateless people or GLBT people or Muslim and Arab and racialized populations of people and religious minorities don't have access to things like religious freedom or freedom of movement in the same ways that the majority population does. That this is about how Western secularism enables settler colonialism or enables white supremacy or enables discrimination in numerous ways. And so it's really about thinking about imagining more just ways of being religious or non-religious or secular, and sort of changing our understanding of what it means to be human. So thinking about what are different ways and models for us to imagine ourselves in relationship with each other, different ways of governing ourselves, different ways of living in community and relating to each other. I think literature and art provide not just critiques, but they give us these really imaginative alternatives to thinking about what it means to be human and how we could be human with each other and how we can be socially embedded and take care of one another. And that is ultimately the most important takeaway, I think, from my book.
It's a great book. I hope people will pick it up and check it out and buy a couple of copies as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I hope you can tell us a little bit about some of the things you're working on now.
I would love to do that. So what I'm working on now is two book projects, which, I mean, the pandemic has really challenged me. I had these research trips that were planned, and I think you can understand that.
Yes. What is working in a pandemic?
What is working in a pandemic? I have two projects that I started last year that have been stalled by homeschooling children and pandemic living, but that I hope to sort of take up again. And the first comes out of an article in a book chapter that I wrote on eco-criticism in Arab American literature. And it was about, the article was about water occupation and sort of thinking about how Arab American authors write about water occupation and thinking about connections between settler colonialism in Palestine and the United States, and specifically thinking about that through water imagery and the occupation of water. And sort of wanting to grow this into a book about eco-criticism in Arab American literature and art. I think that often in terms of environmental studies, there are very particular kinds of categories and canons that we look to as literary scholars to think about environmental studies and to think about how we live in the biosphere and what literature can tell us about living differently with it. And there is very little writing about how Arab American writers and artists contribute to this and can help us think about things like environmental racism and slow violence, that's Rob Nixon's term, or thinking about settler colonialism and thinking about environmental justice and thinking about the ways that things like conflict and occupation and invasion and neoliberalism contribute to environmental injustice and how these writers and artists give us different, again, just different ways of thinking about being human, this time being human in relationship to the biosphere and the species that we share it with. And the other book project is one I was working on with a colleague, Mukti Magaram, who is at Rutgers, and it's about empathy in literature and how literature can help us, can give us models for empathizing differently. So one of the things I talk a lot about in my chapters on Lalami and Hajj, for example, is how we are often, literature is often called upon to make us empathize with its characters and supposedly like become better humans. And maybe then that will sort of extend into the world and we will, you know, fight for social justice because we read a particular book. And thinking about how that model doesn't necessarily work and how we could think about empathy and literature differently.
These sound like wonderful projects, and I hope you get time soon to work on them. Well, thanks again, and congrats on this wonderful book, Interrogating Secularism.
Thank you so much.
That was my conversation with Danielle Huck about Interrogating Secularism, Race and Religion in Arab Transnational Art and Literature, published with Syracuse University Press in 2019. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Islamic Studies.